Sir Brooks Richard, Richard's real one. Where were you born, Sir Brooks?
I was born in July 1918 at Southampton, where my father was number two in the government rolling mill at Woolston, producing cartridge cases for the army. He was an engineer, and before the war had been had learnt his business at Cowes, Isle of Wight, in a shipyard, building engines for steam yachts, and he had become very keen on sailing while living at Cowes, and I had my introduction to the sea because of this in my childhood.
What had been your education?
Well, I went to prep school at Seaford, no longer exists, St. Wilfrid's, where, but I went on to Stowe in 1931, and that date must be wrong, never mind, I went on to Stowe, and from Stowe in due course, having become a history specialist, I went to Magdalen, Cambridge as an exhibitioner and had finished my second year at Cambridge when the Second World War began. I was very keen in my, very clear in my own mind, having become in my school days and when at Cambridge, an amateur yacht designer, and very early on became a member of the Royal Ocean Racing Club. I was very clear that I wanted to serve in the Navy rather than in the Army. But this was really quite impracticable to join the RNVR and be in statu pupillari at the university, because one would have had to go to Hull or to Brighton to do one's drills, as HMS President was totally overfilled. And the university authorities wouldn't allow undergraduates to swan about the country, even to do a day's naval training each week. So there was rather an impasse about this, how those who wanted, in the event of an emergency, to join the Navy could clearly mark themselves off. And fortunately, I found an ally at Cambridge in the person of the Master of Downing College, who was Vice Admiral Sir Herbert Richmond at the time, a distinguished and highly literate sailor, who took up our cause. We had volunteered to give up enough of our long vacation to do training with the Navy, but that was turned down as impracticable. They hadn't got the facilities. And we did eventually get an undertaking that, in the event of an emergency, was the phrase used at the time, anybody who had a naval vacation would be interviewed and given a chance to declare his preference. And I joined the OTC in the gunners section just to show willing at Cambridge, but determined not to be in the army. And then came the outbreak of war during long vacation. I was in Germany trying to learn German, and where I'd been at the time of Munich the year before. And I got back, though assured by my firmly anti-Nazi friends. My host was had been the rector of Münster University, but had been sacked by Hitler in late 1938, and was living in Cologne. He said on the day Hitler invaded Poland, "Well, obviously your government and the French are really too wet to do anything about this." and you might just as well go off as you'd planned down to Bavaria next week. I said, well, Professor, I don't think I agree with you about that, and I think I'm going to leave this very day. And I got out, therefore, across the frontier without any worse difficulty than having to leave behind a lot of books I'd bought with unconvertible Reichsmarks that were too heavy to carry. But I was back, therefore, in England when the air raid sirens went and we knew that we were at war. I applied my time waiting to be called up by taking by correspondence course a yacht master's certificate, which was the equivalent of a master's certificate of the ordinary variety minus the sea time, but the examination was the same. And in September and first part of October, I rushed through this thing, went up to Liverpool and sat my exams. I failed the signalling portion, but got through all the rest, and then never had time to do the signalling, but was called up and sent to HMS King Alfred, which is an underground garage at Hove, and said very firmly, I wanted to serve in small ships, which I thought was anything I knew anything about. And they, at the end of a week, such was the hurry, I was whipped off to HMS Vernon, having been told I was going to be sent on a minesweeping course. And we were... The course itself, I think, was only a week, and it was all about conventional Oropesa sweep, as developed in the First War for sweeping moored mines. And on the last day, when we were just preparing to go home, we were in the mess, go home for a weekend, we were in the mess, and on the lawn, somebody pointed out to us a diver was... walking across the lawn and approaching an object in the middle of it. They said, well, that object in the middle of the lawn is something we've just discovered, which is the mechanism of a magnetic mine dropped on a mud bank in the Thames estuary where it dried out, and very heroically taken to pieces by somebody who signaled back by a semaphore each time he removed a part, in case he got blown up. And we're just trying to find out whether we can remove these darn things by sending divers down to attach ropes to them to pull them up. But of course, we've got to find out whether the diver is magnetic because of his helmet, to the point that would blow him up. Well, you may hear more of these, they said. So we went off for a weekend leave. On Monday, I was ordered to Glasgow. There'd obviously been a good deal of over-weekend work on the subject of how these new magnetic mines might be swept, and I reported at the naval headquarters at Glasgow, and there were three other sub-lieutenants, RNVR, and we were told that we would be put up in the hotel, the Lenox Hotel. But only for a very brief time, because we would be sent to take over some ships. Well, I can't remember how many days later, but very, very promptly, we were sent down to what was then Denny's shipyard at Dumbarton, where they built destroyers, as a particular specialist thing, where eight herring drifters had been brought in from fishery with their fishing crews on board, and we found that equipment had been assembled and prepared in the yard to equip them in such a way that four of the drifters would have searchlight generators in the hold, two in each of the fish holds, whereas the other four would have large electromagnetic coils mounted on their decks, 22 feet across, that had been fabricated on a wooden platform in Denny's shipyard. The vessels being suitably ballasted with road metal, and the coil being inclined so that the electromagnetic field would, they hoped, be behind the drifter, itself being a wooden vessel, there was a steam engine, and they hoped, therefore, that when these drifters were paired off, one towing with the generators on board and the other with evacuated but with the coil energized, you'd have something that would blow up a mine on the seabed. Everything was in a great state of hurry. We were told to prepare the ships for sea as quick as possible. The crews were asked which of them would volunteer for naval service, and half of them did. The gaps being made good with men from the Lowestoft Royal Naval Patrol Service depot, and there was no source for naval victualling, so we went and requisitioned enough food from the Dumbarton Cooperative and put off to sea, escorted by two destroyers, the Fury and the Foxhound, bound for Loch Ewe on the west coast of Scotland, where the flagship of the Home Fleet, HMS Nelson, had been mined by a submarine-laid mine. Well, we arrived there in December 1939, and in these very dirty little ships, converted as rapidly as they were, and tied up alongside this impeccable, even though partly incapacitated, battleship, and were welcomed on board and told we were members of the wardroom. The problem was to find a clean shirt and clean collar, because I'd only got half a uniform at the time, and I'd stowed it all in a tin box from Messrs. Gieves, and had to go in the engine room, where it had been put rather too close to the boiler, and half a pound of butter given me by a maiden aunt had melted all over my shirts and collars, so it was quite difficult to clean oneself up to the acceptable standard. We managed, in the ensuing days, to sweep the first magnetic mine ever swept, therefore to clear a channel out of which the Nelson could take to sea, go to sea, and be repaired in the dockyard. Funnily enough, the mine was swept just outside the buoyed channel and blew up the drifter, was destroyed, and the chap in charge of that pair of drifters got Right Royal blowing up for having not switched off the current at the right point. Anyhow, it did demonstrate, even at the cost of the loss of drifter, that the gear functioned. And I was next told that I would have to stand by the conversion of another drifter on the Clyde and the preparation of sweeping gear. So I spent some weeks while this was going on at Greenock, living in Glasgow, where a kind unknown man on a corporation tram said to me one day, seeing me in naval uniform, "Where are you staying?" And I said, "I'm staying at the Index Hotel." "It's a filthy hole," he said. "Why don't you come to my club?" "Oh," I said, "but I'm with three other officers." Well, he said, bring them too. So we all went to the Constitutional Club, right in the middle of Glasgow, where we were the only guests, and we had marvellous service and very good food. I quote this because people of Scotland, and indeed of the North in general, were so hospitable to young naval officers in those days, vastly more so than would ever have been the case in the South. And we were really very well looked after. When finally the fitting out of the ship I was to take over, HMS Jewel, was complete, we were ordered to take her and one other drifter, the Harvest Gleaner, towing what was termed a skid each. The skid was a pair of pontoons with the electromagnetic coil mounted between the two of them. The idea being that you'd only destroy this rather than destroy a ship each time you swept a mine. And I was involved from, I think, March 1940 through till end of July 1940, keeping Belfast Lock swept every morning. And shortly before the end of that period, we were told to take our ships and to sail them over a range that had been fixed at Belfast Lock, which was to measure the magnetism under the vessels. Well, when this was done, it was revealed that the ships they built of wood were really quite magnetic because of the engine and the propeller shaft and all that, which is very substantial being a steam engine. So that if we'd had the misfortune to go over a shallow-laid mine, we would undoubtedly have blown up during all the weeks that we'd been sweeping. There were two procedures in use in the summer of 1940 for dealing with this type of situation. One was degaussing, which is familiar to anyone who wants to know about it. You passed cables round the ship and energized these. That was fitted to merchant ships. The other was to wipe the ship by putting cables temporarily round and putting electric shock through it to demagnetize it. And this was thought sufficient in the case of a wooden drifter, so we were wiped, as the phrase had it at the time. And I, at that point, was transferred to a new command, leaving the Jewel in Belfast. And it was lucky change of ship because the Jewel was blown up 3 weeks after I left, with the loss of everybody on board off Grey Point, Belfast Lock. And years later, when I went back to Belfast as security coordinator in Northern Ireland in the early 1980s, I met an old member of the Royal Ulster Yacht Club, and I was telling him this tale, and he said, "Oh, I never knew why one of our racing marks off Grey Point was called the Jewel Mark. We race around that every time we have a race day in Belfast Lock, and it still bears the name of the ship." He didn't know what was the cause of the name. But the ship I joined was bigger. It was a steel whale catcher belonging to the Salveson Whaling Company of Leith, but they're an Anglo-Norwegian company, and they'd come straight back with their whaling crews from South Georgia, and I found myself with my signals officer, the only British officers on board, the whole of the rest of the crew being Norwegian. And my first lieutenant was the gunner from this ship, the gunner being the man who shoots the whale, but he's also the captain of the ship, so he was very familiar with her. And not long after I joined her, we were, and this was of course no longer the same method of sweeping as I'd been familiar with before. It was the double L sweep that had been introduced then. And we were ordered south to Plymouth in August 1940. And down the Irish Sea and round Land's End we came, and I suddenly, in the middle of the night, rounding Land's End, which I knew in pre-war sailing quite well, I realized for the first time in 130 years, one was looking across the channel at a wholly enemy-occupied shore the other side of the channel. I had little idea at that time that it was to be a major concern of mine. We went to Plymouth, that was then being very regularly bombed. We swept the entrance to Plymouth, and I was then, not many weeks later, ordered to Falmouth with the Severa, the ship in question, and a second ship of the same type, the Steffa. And Falmouth was a port that I knew really quite well from before the war, because in my yacht designing days, between 1936 and the outbreak of the war, I'd had an unofficial partnership with a retired naval officer living at Falmouth, Lieutenant W.B. Bill Luard, who was very well known in the ocean racing world before the war. He had, in fact, been injured in a submarine accident at the end of the First World War and had contracted TB, the hip, and been invalided out. So he'd not been called up at the beginning of the war. But he had, in the between-war years, been very active in the early racing of the Royal Ocean Racing Club and built the first vessel actually built as an ocean racer for a British owner in a Breton fishing boat yard at Carantec on the Morley River on the north coast of Brittany. This was a vessel called Metinas II, in which he took part in the 1931 transatlantic race. And I came to know him because my father bought a boat off him after he'd sold Metinas, a boat called Alien the Fourth, in '34, I suspect. But I went to Falmouth to take delivery of this ship, met Bill Luard, asked him what he was going to do for the next boat to sail, and he said he wanted to build one because he'd found a fishing boat yard at Mevagissey that was, he thought, had a very high standard of workmanship, and it was run by a man called Percy Mitchell, and he wanted to build a boat of about 9 or 10 tons there. And he described the boat he had in mind, and I felt I could get a very close idea of his requirement, and I went away and I did a plan and sent it to him. I had only previously done plans for model yachts, but he liked the plan I did him, and after subsequent refinements and alterations of detail, the ship was built. and in the Mevagissey yard. Then I went on the following year to build a boat for my father, the Windfall, in the same yard. And Bill Lord, since I couldn't go down there when I was at school in term time, Bill Lord kept an eye on the building. He used to go up there once a week and see what was happening and write to me and tell me what decisions were called for and so on. So this partnership extended to the building of a third vessel down there the following year, to be 1937, the Windstar, for a man called Lieutenant Colonel Philip Ioannidis, who had liked the look of my second boat, built by my father. And she was bigger still. She was 40 feet waterline, and subsequently became the flagship of the Royal Yacht Squadron, because she was bought just before the war by Sir Philip Hunloke, who'd been the King's sailing master in the Britannia, George V's sailing master. And just before such things became impossible at the beginning of the war, I went down and had a day's sailing in the Solent with Hunloke, stayed in the Royal Yacht Squadron, and was with him when he hauled his broad pennant down. And I think that must have been the last time he ever went sailing. But since I knew Bill Lord, therefore, well, I got in touch with him as soon as I arrived at Falmouth, and he was fretting at his inactivity. He'd written several books, I should have said, for the war, and written a lot of articles, papers like Blackwood's, and he said, "Oh, Brooks, do take me to sea, because I want to write about minesweeping." And of course I said, "Yes, of course you can, Bill, come along. Be alongside at 6 o'clock, come down in the dark, I'll arrange you to get through the gate tomorrow morning, 6 o'clock, and we'll go to sea." Well, he came down. I asked nobody's permission. He shouldn't have been on board. However, by chance, the day before that, which was the 4th of November 1940, Admiralty scientists came down and said, "Well, there's a new thing called the acoustic mine, and we want to fit your ship with sweeping gear for that. And we propose, as you've got a four-peak tank, we propose to use that as a drum with a Kango hammer, pneumatic hammer, striking the bulkhead at the after end of it, and we hope this will produce a pattern of sound ahead of the ship which will detonate acoustic mine." Well, they tried it out, but alas, the vessel, which had been built Smith's Dock on the Tees to withstand Antarctic pack ice, was so solidly constructed that the sound, instead of falling ahead of the vessel, came down right underneath her bow. And, they said, "That isn't good enough. We'll take it out, the gear." So they removed it. And the 5th of November was the day I was taking Bill Lord to sea. We shoved off and were sweeping the approaches to Falmouth. And, of course,